The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
We've got political chaos in the UK at the moment. We've got a tanking economy, eye-watering inflation, massive debt, crime on the streets. And the royal family, the monarchy, is there to provide stability. Good luck with that.
I wouldn't recommend you move to the Cotswolds or many other parts of rural England at the moment because, they've decided there's not enough diversity there. And so they must thrust it upon the lovely parts of England where people normally go to get away from the city and all the troubles that are going on in London, etc. No, they say we need more diversity because the place is too white. This is from the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs.
But to actively say, we are going to change the language of government material. We are going to promote a campaign to increase the ethnic diversity of the countryside. Why? No one voted for this. I just don't understand what authority the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs think they have to run an internal migration scheme.
Yet another person has been arrested for burning a Quran.
He is a former Muslim who converted to Christianity and he's from Iraq. He came here and was settled in Bradford and he decided as a religious and political protest to burn his own copy of the Quran. And he posted a video of this on social media. And as a result of this, the Bradford police force arrested him, told him he was going to be charged with a hate crime.
Is this just a case of the police actually effectively making up the law? They're enforcing a law that isn't actually on the books.
Yes, that's exactly what's going on. And we're seeing this time and time again with the British state now attempting to construct some new blasphemy law without actually having to go through the trouble of introducing one in Parliament.
Pro-Palestine protesters have come under fire after displaying flags of the Islamic Republic of Iran alongside cheering support for the regime's tyrannical leader, Al-Khamenei, at a local London rally this weekend. The Iranian regime has just committed the bloodiest crackdown in decades. Many, many people seem to be supporting the regime in Iran. It doesn't make sense to me. We saw people on that march doing Nazi salutes, spitting at people, displaying support for terrorist organisations. And I hate to say this, but there were a group of NHS staff there who were wearing their hospital scrubs on a march through London, supporting a regime that has just murdered 40,000 people, and that's a conservative estimate.
We have seen spitting, Nazi salutes, and gestures of beheading. Disgusting. People are also praising Ayatollah Khomeini, the Iran's terrorist Islamist ruler.
So, last message for Mr. Khomeini. We all love Khomeini.
We all love Ayatollah Khamenei. I am too little to send him a message. All I am saying is that he is not only the pride of the Iranian nation, but he is also the pride of the Muslim world. He has been the best politician ever so far. All these rumours about him being a dictator have no value at all.
What's wrong with these people? This is happening in broad daylight on the streets of Britain's capital city.
Thank you. Yesterday, I think personally what we saw in London was shocking, absolutely shocking. There was even one woman that the audio isn't great, but she appears to be saying that the murder of many innocent, many young Iranians on the streets in Iran was nice.
That's correct, yes. And to have the London, the city of democracy, the city where Sir Winston Churchill walked through be diminished into Nazi Islamism is shameful and it's dangerous.
It's being increasingly clear that the spread of radical Islam is being completely ignored, allowing this ideology to fester and radicalise, I'd argue, at this point, millions of people living in Britain.
A snapshot of Britain today, and it's not a pretty picture, is it? It's a sickness. It's a sickness. It's easy to dwell on the sickness in the United States, but Britain, as you heard there, political chaos, crime in the streets, overrun with immigrants, radical Islam, taking to the streets to support, just in the last two, 3 years, people in Britain, citizens, I guess, taking to the streets to support Hamas and now Iran. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this program at thetrumpet.com or at the Rumble channel, rumble.com/Trumpet Daily. You can leave us feedback at td@thetrumpet.com. So we'd love to hear from you. I know we haven't gotten to much feedback of late, and that's because we haven't gotten to all the news stories that we keep wanting to cover. They keep piling up, and we do go more in-depth into stories, I guess, than so many other programs, and that's just the way we like doing it. But let's focus here in this first segment. We'll see how long it goes. That was a pretty long montage, but Britain is sick. My father had an article. This was 2015, so over 10 years ago, about the sickness. He says, the reality is that Britain is very sick today. I mean, if you look into the prophecies of Hosea, it compares Britain, in time Britain, Ephraim in the Bible, to a moth-eaten garment that just falls apart suddenly when you take it off of the hanger, or a cake that hasn't been turned. It's just rotten on the inside. That's in Hosea 5 and Hosea 7, I believe. Sick. Believe it or not, Bible prophecy actually describes modern-day Britain as a sick people. It suffers from rampant immigration problems, an unsustainable welfare system that is destroying the character of its citizens. This was at thetrumpet.com 10 years ago. Social problems that are swallowing the populace in drunkenness and immorality, and other ills. My father says the fact that it has largely forgotten its own history and even despises what little it still remembers is a big part of what is causing many of these disasters. I mean, it's upside down. I mean, the guy on the street singing praises to the Ayatollah. And then on the other hand, a guy that burns a Quran, well, he goes to jail, of course. Hosea 13 talks about Ephraim's sins and how that glory, and I mean, it had as much glory as any empire in history, more than any empire in history, the greatest empire in the history of human civilization, the British Empire, and that glory has faded. Hosea 13 says, yet I am the Lord your God, verse 4, and you shall know no God but me, for there is no Savior beside me, O Israel. Verses 9 and 10, it says, you have destroyed yourself. You have destroyed yourself, but in me is your help. I will be your king. I mean, if only we would turn to our king, to our God. It shows just how far removed we are from God and the teachings of God. There was this article at the Free Press, I think it is. It's really hard to get through. It's just so disgusting. The rate of abortions in Britain and how that they're just so common, like 1 in 3 women. This article starts with this case study. Her name's Gemma. She's 28 years old. And she didn't realize she was pregnant until about 5 months in. So, I mean, there was a pretty big or sizable human life inside of her stomach. inside the womb. She didn't know it. And so 5 months in, she goes through this gut-wrenching abortion process. And then it talks about all the pain that she experienced after the fact. Says this was, after all, her third abortion in as many years. Imagine three abortions in 3 years. When I asked Gemma whether she was unusual among her friends, she paused. I wouldn't say they've all had multiple abortions, but they've definitely had one. Yeah, I'm 28. I mean, I'm ready for sex. I'm ready for having a live-in boyfriend. I'm ready for an abortion even. If we don't use protection, if we don't use birth control. But I'm certainly not ready to give birth to a child made in the image of God. We've been going through Mystery of the Ages in depth and fundamentals of theology. And you look at God's plan and purpose, and that's why these stories are so sad and tragic. I mean, people don't understand why we're here and what we're meant to do and what we're preparing for. And who and what we're made in the image of, ultimately. Abortion is increasingly common in the UK. According to government statistics released last week, close to 1 in 3 pregnancies in Britain now ends in termination. So here they're being overrun by radical Islam, just inviting in the world, and just like we did under the Obama years here in America. And then, I guess, actual British citizens, well, they just don't want to give birth. They don't want to grow their own population. Biggest reason, and you'll be, I think, surprised by this, that most of these women, I mean, they're not even talking about, you know, the economics that, well, I can't afford it and this and that. And, well, you know, the boyfriend is against it. Or it's not that. It's like, I'm not ready to raise children. I don't want to do it. Experts have attributed the rise to an increase in the cost of living. However, the idea that rising abortion rates are primarily the result of financial desperation is, to put it generously, incomplete. I spoke to a dozen British women of different ages across the country about their abortions. The cost of having a child did not come up, not once, even among younger or working class women. Instead, and listen to this, the reasons sounded like this. My relationship with the father didn't feel stable enough. I didn't feel ready to become a parent. I feel it's wrong to have a child when I'm so damaged. The poor child deserves better than me. I could never be a parent because I overanalyze everything. And then finally, I just think I would have irreparably messed them up. It uses a profane word. But yeah, if I give birth, I would have produced a messed up child because of how messed up my life is and how messed up my parents' lives were. I mean, this is sad. This is horrible. In other words, more so than the financial strain, what emerged was a pervasive belief that parenthood is a high-risk opportunity to do irreversible harm, and that opting out entirely is the responsible choice. So I would harm that new life, that new baby. So instead they opt to kill it. This is where we are in Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh's right there with them. And it's so easy to get abortions. These clinics, they're all over the place in Britain, in the United States. We played this clip of Herbert Armstrong on Friday's program. Sorry, in Friday's class, Fundamentals of Theology. You know, it's Mr. Armstrong in the last year of his ministry, and he's talking about why we're called into the church, and he said Jesus came as a teacher, and he selected disciples. I think I've touched on this already this week, but he said, you're students, and you're in training to learn, to teach. You've got to be able to teach young people. You've got to be able to teach new people coming into God's family. I mean, ultimately, that's what we're going to be doing for all eternity. And yet you have so many in Britain today and in the United States. I mean, it's exactly the opposite. And just seeing it, you know, there's a real spirit world, and you know the devil is behind this movement to destroy family, to destroy children, to destroy the God family vision, if he could. Here are all these young people in their 20s terminating their pregnancies. I mean, that's sugarcoating it. Let's be honest. Abortion is murder. Here they are murdering their babies, human beings inside the womb, because they don't think they have anything to teach that new life. They don't feel like they can handle the responsibility to raise a child. You know, and it's easy to single out the women, but where are the men? Where are the fathers? Where's the responsibility? Where's the willingness to sacrifice for that new life, for that child? Here again, just looking at the contrast, look at what God was willing to sacrifice for a family. He sent his own son as a lamb sacrifice, so that we might be forgiven of our sins upon repentance and faith, and then eventually be born into God's family. John 3, read the exchange between Jesus and Nicodemus in John 3. Read John 1, where Christ, it talks about God and the Word. And then the Word came in the flesh as Jesus Christ, and he became the Son of God at that moment. And it says in John 1 and verse 18 that Jesus declared the Father. And here theologians today, they read through all these verses and conclude that God is certainly not a family, he's a Trinity. And Trinity doesn't even appear in the Bible. They make it up. And as Mr. Armstrong said in chapter 1 of this book, what the Trinity does is it shuts man out of God's family. I want to read to you some verses I read yesterday in class. This is from John 10 and verse 30, where Jesus says, I and my Father are one. God the Father, Christ the Son, and they are one. How are they one? Well, they're one in spirit, in understanding. They work. You know, John 5 says, I work, my Father works. They're unified. They're together. They are family. They are Father and Son. They're one. And then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Why would they want to kill him for this? These are the religious leaders, the elites, the scholars, the ones that really knew the Old Testament through and through. Jesus answered them, many good works have I showed you from my Father. For which of these works do you stone me? And the Jews answered him, saying, for a good work we stone you not, but for blasphemy. And because that you, being a man, make yourself God. How could you say this? There's just one God. There's not two. There's not a Father and Son family. And Christ goes on and says in verse 34, is it not written in your law? I said, you are gods? Well, can't you see that in Psalm 82? If you're experts in the Old Testament, haven't you read that you are gods? I mean, you have the potential to be born into God's family. God is a family. Father, Son, the church is the bride, Ephesians 5, Revelation 19. And then children. Children come along into it. The church being right up there on the mother level. I could give you all the scriptures, I suppose, but it would turn into a 55-minute Bible study, a scripture blitz. It's all over the Bible. But you see how human beings react to that message. It's blasphemy. We have to stone you. We have to kill you. We have to terminate you. What a contrast. God paid the ultimate price to open up his family to all of mankind. He said that in the first chapter of the Bible. This is my purpose. This is my plan, to reproduce myself, to make man in my likeness and image. He's to be like me. Matthew 5:48 says, become you perfect like your Father in heaven is perfect. That's the goal. That's the aim. That's the destination. That's God's purpose and plan. And it's all explained beautifully and very simply put forth in Mystery of the Ages. There's a beautiful simplicity to it, the plan of God, the purpose. And yet the world is blinded to it because there is a real spirit world, because the God of this world hates the God family vision, and he's destroying family on the physical level because of it. There's a conspiracy against fatherhood, motherhood, family living, children. Satan loves it when young ladies in Britain and America terminate pregnancies, because that little life, I mean, the potential for that little life is to be born into the image, the likeness and the image of a God being. Childbirth in the physical realm, it's a type of salvation. And Satan knows this and he hates it. Look at how far women today are willing to go to avoid the responsibility, to avoid the opportunity, to avoid the blessing that it is to raise beautiful children made in the likeness of God, to be made in the image of God. Is there any greater blessing? It's not like it's easy. I'm not saying it's easy to raise children. It is challenging. It is demanding. You do have to make sacrifices. But when you use God's law, when you use the Holy Bible to guide you in that process, I mean, what could be more rewarding as you see life go by so quickly? We only have a short time on this earth to prepare for our future calling in God's family. But as you advance in age and to see your children grow up and receive a godly education, and then to produce children of their own, and then your grandparents. And I mean, that's a wonderful cycle, and it just goes by so quickly. But here are these lives, and they're talked about in this article. And people, you read between the lines, and basically what people are saying is, look, I'm miserable. I'm unhappy. I wouldn't know the first thing about what to do. So let's just terminate. Hannah is 31, lives in Manchester. Been to that city many times. When she became pregnant last year, she booked an abortion almost immediately. She has a stable job, a long-term partner. I just knew I couldn't do it, she told me. Not because I didn't want a child, in theory I do, but because I didn't trust myself. I just couldn't do it. I just can't trust myself to do it. I'm too messed up. She described herself repeatedly as too messed up to be a mother, but struggled to explain where specifically she got this idea from. It's everything, she said. Everywhere you look, someone is explaining how their parents ruined them. So, I mean, this is a generational thing. Herbert Armstrong was right. He came out in the first book that later became The Missing Dimension in Sex. It appeared in 1964, I believe. And the title of it was God Speaks Out on the New Morality, the so-called New Morality. Well, as it turns out, it wasn't so new. But it was a pendulum swing coming out of the old morality to the new morality where anything goes. Yeah, anything. Marriage is becoming obsolete, divorce common, and of course abortion coming into the 1970s. Whether it's Roe v. Wade or whatever it was in Britain, but I mean, we're leading the way for the whole world, terminating pregnancies, committing murder by the tens of thousands. Millions, in fact. One woman I spoke to, a 33-year-old from Wales, who asked to remain anonymous, put it plainly. I don't think of abortion as a tragedy, she told me. I think of it as a reset. Having a child feels irreversible. Abortion doesn't. You think we've got our work cut out for us in the world tomorrow when we're going to have to re-educate these people, these people who think like this? Well, you have a child and it's irreversible. It's a curse. At least abortion hits the reset button. What a satanic, deranged way to think about human reproduction. God designed it. God made it. Every year in Principles of Living, we watch a video that just shows the miraculous process from conception to the point of birth. And what a beautiful type it is of our future in God's family. Education is the key. Young people need to know that building a family is, well, that's our calling, our purpose in life, in the physical sense and especially the spiritual. And so we need education. We need training. You know, and young people come to this college, Armstrong College, and they go into classes like marriage and family, principles of living, fundamentals of theology, life and teachings of Jesus Christ. I touched on this yesterday. I mean, if you're convinced that everything in the Gospels is true, well, let's take a deep dive into it and see what Jesus said about family. See what he said about divorce. See what he said about homosexuality. See what he said about the last days and how he compared it to Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's see what he said about nuclear weapons and whether or not they're going to be used. Christ told us. Christ prepared us for where we are right now. But what you read about in this article, you read about young people that are thoroughly unprepared for what's coming. You can see why Herbert Armstrong used to say, it's going to snap on us suddenly like a trap. It's going to take that to finally wake us up. Here's why so many of them do it, and they don't have any problem. There's one woman that said, you know, I'd rather remain anonymous, but most of them give their name. Yeah, I'm from Liverpool, right? Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, having a child, you can't reverse that. And having an abortion, it's just a nice, easy reset. The vast majority of Brits, almost 90%, believe abortions should be allowed, and nearly two-thirds think the law should be more permissive, enabling a nurse to sign off on an abortion rather than a doctor. Abortion is now largely destigmatized. For most people, it's seen as a backup when contraception fails or when women fail to use it. A lot of them just make the choice. Yeah, well, I'm ready for sex without protection. And then if there's consequences, well, you hit the reset button. No problem. And what makes it even easier in the UK is the NHS. Yeah, it's free. It's funded by the taxpayers. I mean, this next bit here, as I say, it's sickening. Multiple women told me that abortion care is also a lot better organized, more efficient, and easier to access than most services within the NHS. Now, I'm here to tell you, with a little bit of experience, I'm not British, but I lived there for 6 years, the NHS is a disaster. It's destroying the UK, its finances, its economy. All these social programs, it's just like my father wrote in that 2015 article. It's a mess. You want to talk about messed up? Look into the NHS. And yet, what does the NHS do particularly well? Well, that would be kill babies. Yeah, they've got it down to, it's just, you move through quickly. It's no problem. It's efficient. And they want to make it even easier. Who's behind this? You know who's behind it. The one thing the NHS does really well, that would be terminate pregnancies. Sophie, age 33, who lives in London, described the abortion care she received in 2020 while in an abusive relationship as night and day compared with her experience with NHS healthcare more broadly. She's had bad experiences with NHS until she needed an abortion. How sick is this? How sick is this? She says it was efficient. You weren't waiting in a room. Things were clearly explained, and I was very comfortable. Abortion care, she said, is so well run compared to other services for women. I mean, that is just infuriating. This is where we are. Is Britain sick? Is America sick? Mr. Livingston reminded me of the Lyceum Address by Abraham Lincoln, where he talked about our nations, the most ominous threat that there is for either of our nations, America and Britain. It's dying by suicide. This is what suicide looks like on a national level. This is what we're seeing. We're killing ourselves. Finally, this article says, when the most supported, least terrifying option is the one that ends up or ends a pregnancy, it's unsurprising that so many more women are choosing it. It's supported by the government. The government wants to make it easier. All of society agrees with it. They feel like you should have just unlimited abortions, 3-4 abortions, no problem. In that article from 2015, my father said, the British people need to recognize that their great national blessings were not a result of chance or luck. They weren't a product of British ingenuity. They were gifts from God because of the spectacular obedience of Abraham. Wouldn't it be wonderful if Britons understood this and gave God credit? Well, and how about just turning to God in repentance? I mean, it shows too how unwilling we are to consider God's ways, to consider God, period. When you're there in the article, yeah, I terminated my pregnancy. Why? Well, I'm so messed up. Well, do you want help? Are you seeking a way out of your messed up life? Or does the train wreck just continue from here on out? We're going to be attacked from without. And look at what's happening right now from within. You saw in the cold open all these Britons taking to the streets to support the Ayatollah. Yeah, I think the Ayatollah is a great leader. He's a great leader. I'm talking about him as if, you know, as if the people of Iran voted him in, I guess. They've been under the rule of a dictatorship, a radical Islamist extremist government since 1979. And in the last 35 days, you have seen the most violent crackdown on an Iranian uprising since 1979. Tom Gross, he's a commentator from the UK. He basically focuses on Middle East and Israel and so on. I saw a video this morning of him. He's going through not just the regular New York Times. He's going through the New York Times international edition, okay? So this is it doesn't focus even on America. It focuses more on international developments. So he's holding up all these New York Times, and the uprising started about 35 days ago. So he goes through, you know, January 1, here's January 4th, here's January 15th. Nothing about Iran and the Ayatollah and the fact that they killed 40,000 of their own people. Nothing. Until the evidence was so obvious and people were starting to report it, then finally, I think it was January 17th or 18th, they had something to say about the uprising in Iran. Other than that, though, even though it's a lot quieter in Gaza, I mean, Gaza, that is a talking point that they hit and they hit and they hit over and over and over. And no wonder people in London are taking to the streets to talk about how wonderful the Ayatollah is. Because there's a blackout on the truth. They blot out the truth. They're driven by an agenda, a demonic one at that. And look, it's not like it's just the New York Times or the UK. President Trump's sending Witkoff to negotiate with Iran this week in Turkey. Yeah, we got to make peace with Iran. I mean, we were sending the fleet over there and it's getting close, but now, you know, it's kind of died down because, like President Trump said, the hangings, the public hangings ended. Well, the Ayatollah ended the lives of 40,000 of his own citizens. 40,000! You lose 4,000 in collateral damage in Gaza. I mean, that's headlines for 3 months. If you want to know what treachery means, look no further than the reactionary march through London on Saturday. This is also from the Free Press. You witness these dumb Londoners singing the praises of the Islamic Republic at the very moment the great people of Iran are fighting to dislodge that wicked regime. Hitting the streets to laud the ruthless theocrats of Tehran would be bad at any time. Doing it when thousands of people have been massacred by those theocrats for the crime of longing for liberty is unforgivable. And yet it happened. Right here in free, modern London, in their thousands, they traipsed to spout their conformist drivel about the dastardly Jewish state and their harebrained belief that the Ayatollahs of Iran are a force for good. It was dolled up as a protest, but really it was a mass dancing on the graves of those butchered by the mullahs. I mean, just when you thought it couldn't get any more disgusting than just being so casual about killing babies. Yeah, I can't have a baby. I'm too messed up. Then you get to the protests, quote unquote. Really, they're celebrating all of those Iranians that were butchered in the last 35 days. How about that? You think they're going to be put in jail? No, that's reserved for one guy that burned a Quran. He needs to be in prison for sure. But not these protests. It's free speech, right? It is free speech. And by the way, you know, the Jews are a pretty big problem. So predictable. Indeed, far from offering solidarity to Iranians, some of these fake progressives mocked those poor souls. Some cheered their killers. Some carried placards featuring the face of Khomeini. Others waved the flag of the Islamic Republic. Waving the Iranian, it's not enough to wave the flag of Hamas. Now it's the flag of Iran. Does this reflect health, good health and conditioning in the spiritual sense for the people of Britain? There were calls to de-proscribe not only Palestine action, but also Hezbollah and Hamas. Just imagine you are a 21-year-old Iranian woman whose face has been caved in by some misogynistic brute from Lebanon, and then you see people in London standing not with you, but with him. Stand with the butchers. Mobs of people sided with Islamist fanaticism. They cozied up to the killers of women. They aligned themselves publicly and proudly with the venal Ayatollah classes who are content to lay waste to thousands of lives if it will help them to preserve the Quranic power. We'll have to see what Gadi Taib thinks about these stories and what's happening in Britain and the support in the Western world, the support in the United States and Britain for the Ayatollah, for the mullahs, for Hamas, for the butchers. He'll be on the program tomorrow. This last bit, it says, for how much longer will we surrender our streets to the Israel haters and the Ayatollah fan club, to the Intifada-cheering middle classes and the mullah-loving Islamists, to those who think the Jewish nation fighting back against its invaders is genocide, but the mass murder of protesters by tooled-up theocrats is nothing to get worked up about. What an infuriating article. I've just gone through two. But what a reflection on our sickness from within. You can't explain why the focus at the International New York Times would be on Israel, 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 even when there's a massacre going on in Iran. You can't explain it unless you understand something about Satan's hatred for Jews, spiritual Jews and physical Jews, both. He hates God's purpose. He hates the fact that God's reproducing himself. He hates the fact that God is creating a spiritual family of Jews. And so you see Satan on the attack. Well, there is, in that same book of Hosea I mentioned at the start, there are verses that talk about God bringing Ephraim and Manasseh back into the fold. But it's only after they've gone through a great tribulation and have had to suffer through some very painful lessons. As I say, it's not just the UK that's showing its support for Iran. It's the Jeroboam administration sending its envoys to Turkey to negotiate with the Iranian diplomats. They're just trying to make peace, right? This is from Fox News, clip 5.
The U.S. and Iran are reportedly preparing for talks in Turkey this week in hopes of easing tensions between the two nations. This as the Ayatollah warns the U.S. not to attack Iran, posting on X, quote, "The Americans should know if they start a war, this time it will be a regional war." But President Trump isn't backing down, saying this when asked by a reporter.
On Iran, the Supreme Leader today said that U.S. attack could spark a regional war. Giving you response to that?
Why wouldn't he say that? Of course you're going to say that, but we have the biggest, most powerful ships in the world over there, very close, a couple of days, and hopefully we'll make a deal. If we don't make a deal, then we'll find out whether or not he was right.
The meeting's set for this Friday in Turkey. Axios has this to say, as Trump's armada moved into place, the protests were quashed and the momentum was lost. Behind the scenes, there were doubts in the West Wing about whether U.S. bombs could really bring decisive political change. And there were concerns about Iran's threats of massive retaliation across the region. At the same time, Turkey, Qatar, Egypt, and other countries undertook an intense diplomatic effort to defuse the situation, eventually producing the meeting planned for Friday in Istanbul. So there was plan for action. The armada's moving into place. But the mullahs crushed the protests. And then there's advisors in the West Wing saying, now the response from Iran, if we attack, it could be brutal. So President Trump, I mean, just reading the, again, Axios may be off, who knows. But it appears as though President Trump changed his mind thanks to his advisors. Don't do it. Don't do it. They got away with crushing 40,000 civilians just in the last month. What does this reveal about America's sickness? About America's weakness? I mean, you've got people coming out in these articles basically saying, yeah, Donald Trump, you know, he reconsidered. This is from Reuters. Iranian sources told Reuters last week that Trump had demanded three conditions for the resumption of talks: zero enrichment of uranium in Iran, limits on Tehran's ballistic missile program, and ending its support for regional proxies. Iran has long rejected all three demands as unacceptable infringements of its sovereignty. And so what does the U.S. go ahead and do? Well, set up the negotiations, of course. We still want to have dialogue, right? We still want to have a meeting. My father spoke to this about a year ago, just after the inauguration. Witkoff, the envoy, the diplomat, you know, the peacemaker. And sitting down with representatives of the number one state sponsor of terrorism that says to these demands, absolutely not. Not going to do it. The U.S. official said the summit in Istanbul will focus on trying to put together a package deal that prevents war. Imagine going into a summit where the U.S. official, I assume he's leaking this. I don't know if he's quoted. I didn't read the whole article, but he goes, we're going in basically with the goal of preventing war. I mean, that should be Iran's goal. We want to go into this to try to convince the United States not to go to war with us, not to strike us. But, I mean, I guess you can't rule out a strike. Maybe if President Trump changes his mind in one direction, what's to stop him from going back in the other direction? We'll see, but where is our leverage? They don't meet the demands. They get to negotiate. It's like my father said a year ago, they love the negotiations because they always get what they want. Sickness and weakness right there on display. Everyone can see it. The whole world can see it. I mean, there is nothing Hamas officials and Iran and the mullahs officials, there's nothing they love more than sitting down with old Steve Witkoff and hammering together a negotiation or an agreement of some kind, a ceasefire or no war, prevent war. Listen to this from President Trump in the Oval Office, clip 7.
So we have NATO paying, we send missiles over there, they pay us in full. Doesn't cost us 10 cents. And we make money, I guess, but I don't even want to talk about that. Because what I really want to do is save those people from dying. They lose, Mary, can you imagine 25,000 to 30,000 people a month? That's like a stadium full of people every single month. And, you know, I mean, I was blessed with something where I can get these things done. Got 8 of them done.
I was blessed with something that gets these things done. He's talking about ending wars. It's a gift. He has a gift for preventing war. And so Witkoff is on his way for the Friday meeting. And another war. You can add, I guess, another one to the list. All the wars that he's stopped. All the peace that he's making. Blessed with a gift. An Arab source says here, Iran's leadership is increasingly worried a U.S. strike could break its grip on power by driving an already enraged public back onto the streets. According to 6 current and former officials, in high-level meetings, officials told the Ayatollah that public anger over last month's crackdown, the bloodiest since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, has reached a point where fear is no longer a deterrent. What an opportunity for the U.S. to go in there, you know, maybe like they did with Venezuela, and get rid of tyranny and get rid of an abusive dictatorship, a murderous dictatorship. Axios says it's really the Israelis who want a strike. The president is just not there. That's from a senior U.S. official. Imagine leaking that to the press. Yeah, and then, too, people will read that and say, oh, of course, it's those Jews. Those Israelis, they want to see a strike. But, you know, President Trump, he's just not there. He has a gift for peacemaking. And so we're going to sit down with the mullahs or their representatives in Turkey. Turkey that has a leader that absolutely hates and despises Israel. Certainly Bibi Netanyahu. Can't stand him. Won't be in the same room with him. But he loves being in the same room with Witkoff and the mullah's representatives. That is a workable situation. Axios says here, the previous set of nuclear talks ended in war with Trump first tacitly approving Israeli attacks and then directly striking Iran's nuclear facilities in June. The second attempt came last fall when the U.S. tried to use Iran's desire to avoid snapback sanctions to convince the regime to give up its highly enriched uranium. That went nowhere. You know, my father said in that I think we might have made the point on the show a year ago as well, but he said in that message a year ago, he said, you know, what's different? What's different between Jeroboam and Antiochus, between Trump and Obama? Obama was, he was negotiating with Iran for 8 years. He was negotiating with them before he even came into office in 2009. He wanted Iran to have regional hegemony over the Middle East. And then here comes President Trump for his part. Whatever, this is from JNS, whatever else was on his agenda or that of his voters, the second Trump administration was not summoned into existence to reenact the failed foreign policy of former President Barack Obama. And that's the main thing for the president and his team to remember as they engage in negotiations this week with Iran. Iran is going in to do what it's always done, to just string the negotiations along, to buy some time, to keep the U.S. from firing missiles. Axios says the Iranian foreign minister said in a speech Monday, diplomacy is incompatible with pressure, intimidation, and force. We hope that its results will soon become evident. Yeah, and who's the one that uses pressure, intimidation, and force? Well, that's Uncle Sam, of course. It's America, the great Satan. And here, these people have just completed a 35-day war with their own people using pressure, intimidation, force, carrying out murders on tens of thousands of people. Switching back to JNS, it says the Iranians say they want only to discuss the nuclear issue, but that is a formula for Iran to do what it has always done with Western and especially American envoys who are desperate for a deal with the mullahs, prevaricate and string the diplomats along until they give up or give in to Tehran's demands. And yet we go in. We go in as confident as ever, America does. Because we're blessed. We're blessed. Remember what President Trump said about Witkoff last May and how he gained experience on the fly? He's a real estate guy. But this is from May 12th last year, clip 8.
Of Steve Witkoff, who's done a fantastic job. I know a lot of people that have a lot of talent. I know Steve, he had a lot of talent. But I know a lot of people with a lot of talent, but there's one that I thought had a special way about him, special personality, aside from being a good deal maker, had a special way about him. And it was Steve, knew very little about the subject matter, who does, but he learned it in about 2 hours.
Something special about Steve. He's special. And then President Trump yesterday saying he's blessed. They're very confident that they can get a deal done. They're deal makers. And once you get a deal, once you strike a deal, then that's the definition of peace. That's the definition of unity. That's the definition of love. God has a different definition for those words. And we'll have to get into that at another time because as I look at the clock, we are out of time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show, and we'll see you again tomorrow.